This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Well, after 45 days, the 2018 Utah legislative session ended last week, and our state elected officials took on a lot of issues, including education funding, homelessness, election laws, and much, much more. At the end of last week, state lawmakers convened at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah to review this past session and to talk about some of the highlights. On the panel, we had two Democrats, Democratic Minority Leader Representative Brian King of District 28, as well as Democratic Assistant Minority Whip Representative Angelo Romero of District 26. And we had two Republicans in leadership, Republican Speaker of the House Greg Hughes, who will be retiring at the end of this term, and Senate President Wayne Niederhauser. The conversation was moderated by Hinckley Institute Director Jason Perry, who began the conversation with some introductions.
This has been an amazing legislative session. We're so glad you're willing to do this. We know you're up late. Many of us were there, and most of the rest of us were watching at some point. So we're glad that all of you are here. Let me introduce our panelists very quickly, and then we have some questions for all of them. And I'll just start here. The first seat right here, Representative Brian King, is the minority leader in the House, and we're so happy to have him here with us. Also represents all the areas around us here at the University of Utah. Next to him is Speaker Greg Hughes, the Speaker of the House. He's been the Speaker since 2015. Also, I have all my facts right so far.
No. He's been the Speaker since 2004.
Okay, this is going to be a fun panel right here already. Next to him, President Wayne Niederhauser, President of the Senate. He's been the President since 2013. Glad to have you here with us. Next to him, Representative Angela Romero, the Assistant Minority Whip. And you all should know, as we have a chance to hear from all of them, they have been very, very good to us here at the University of Utah. For many years, which we appreciate so much because not many people understand just what an impact the legislature has on the students here. But these four do, and they think about it. Every legislative session, I'll just say as I start this, they meet with the president of the university. They talk about the students. They talk about the priorities. I can't tell you how much we appreciate all of you and what you do for us here as students. I'm going to ask one big question first, and then we're going to have a chance to hear from the students. Is that all right? Since we started this way, we'll go down and start with you, Representative King. Let's just start. A significant piece of legislation you worked on or you helped with during this legislative session, and why it was important for the state.
Well, Brian King, District 28. You're sitting in District 28. Thank you, first of all, Jason, for having us on this day. It's hard to get up and come, but we're glad to show up. I worked on a number of pieces of legislation. I think of Representative Romero, and I worked with Representative Wilson to get an appropriation for the hospital response team of $150,000, which was very important. Getting funds for the zoo, which I had the speaker's help in accomplishing, was important. I mean, I could go down a long list, but if I were going to highlight one list, it wasn't my bill. I was the House sponsor of a bill that started in the Senate from Senator Fillmore that got rid of discretionary authority clauses in insurance policies. It requires that insurance companies, when they go to court, they can't put language in their insurance policies that puts their thumb on the scale once they get to court. That isn't something that anybody heard anything about. It's a very low key, it's very rifle as opposed to shotgun in terms of how many people it affects, but it's absolutely critical for people who have denied life and health and disability claims to get their claims fairly adjudicated, to be able to go to court and have an even playing field as opposed to have the insurance company with their thumb on the scale. That's the kind of stuff that you'll never hear about aside from this, but it happens routinely up there. And the guy that helped me with that years ago is this guy right here. I had a client, my law practice deals with those kind of claims, and I had a client that lived in Representative Hughes' district. It was before he was a speaker, and I sent Tig Representative Hughes way and said, if you don't like what's happened to you, talk to Greg Hughes, and he did, and Representative Hughes became a convert to this whole issue, and he's been working with me closely in the years since then to try and get that changed. So that's the kind of stuff, the degree to which we do things that are collaborative. We say we don't accomplish anything alone, and we don't, but I'll tell you, when you work up at the legislature, you realize very quickly, even a guy like the Speaker, a guy like the President of the Senate, they can't get much done without 75 people plus a whole entourage of others. So
that's true. So I will tell you that it's a good problem to have when you ask what was the major issues you worked on. As Speaker, I don't run bills. I don't know where to start, and that's a good answer to give when you look at the kind of work that we were able to accomplish in this last legislative session. And if you were an intern, you were part of a very unique session, I would argue. I've had 16 that I've served in, and I think that the work that we did on delivering tax cuts and tax relief to Utahns, and also historic funding in public education, as well as equalization and systemic change, property tax having used to have a role. It's been shrinking over the years of how we fund our schools. To see that on a trajectory of how that will be an important part, sustainable part of our public education system. We usually do one or the other, tax relief, funding for education, or record funding. We did both. We looked at transportation. We have now the first Department of Transportation, I think, in the United States, that it's not a roads department like other DOTs are in other states. Now our Department of Transportation will look at multimodal transportation infrastructure. Their job in a growing state is to absorb the growing market share of commuters by whatever means. If that's the president's favorite mode of transportation, bike trails. I'm an adult. I got a driver's license. I don't drive. I don't ride bicycles anymore. So you probably heard me rant about that. But bicycles, you got mass transit. You have roads. We have many It's multimodal. So now you have our Department of Transportation and Carlos Braceras that will program out and will work collaboratively with our cities, counties, transit district to put those projects together in a way that I think is transformation. It's not been done. I think we're going to be a best case scenario for other states. You look at, so that was a big deal. Yeah. Our inland port, that was a huge lift. And I think that is going to be a game changer for our economy. By geography, we are the crossroads of the West. And when you understand or begin to understand the kind of challenges that we have on imports that are just bottlenecked in these ports in Long Beach and Oakland and Portland, and you have ships out there in the oceans just idling for months waiting to get their containers in. There's opportunities. There's inland ports on the east side of Kansas City, Louisville. We don't have anything like it in the western states. And when you see the unique opportunity we have where all the rail lines in the west coast winnow into Utah, when the I-15 is the only road that starts in Alaska, goes through Canada, through the United States, and down through Mexico. It's the only road like it in North America. When you look at our international airport, it is made for that. And when you create that inland port, you'll see an economy, you'll see economic activity that I think is going to really be a long-term game changer for the state. I think it's going to be good. So suicide prevention, we put a lot of work, Representative Ellison's work on that issue. We saw while we were in session the tragedy in Florida, a lot of that. We have been working on suicide prevention, teen suicide prevention for a long time. There's been the ability to find out about at least contemplated violent acts that could be intervened and help. And so we've done a lot more on that space. And then finally, I'd argue that we worked very hard and continue to over the last three sessions on our homeless issue, people experiencing homelessness. We have a funding formula now that is statewide. Everyone's going to throw into the hat. If you're a jurisdiction with a resource center, homeless resource center, there's additional resources for those areas that will come from the other jurisdictions. And so you get if you have, and if you don't have one, you throw into the pot. If you want it and you don't want to pay it, then have a resource center. And there's a great formula for that. So. I think that the work we're doing on that front is one that is a game changer as well. It's all those things are good, and I'm telling you, I'm leaving a lot out, but I know I'm talking too much, so I'm going to let the president speak. But that's the kind of session we had. It was incredible.
Thanks, Speaker. Thank you, Jason. I have a little picture here. You're not going to be able to see it on my phone, but I don't know, maybe those who are in the front can see it. This is a picture on Wasatch Boulevard on a snow day. This is right by the mouth of Big Cottonwood Canyon. The road's going south, and if you've ever been there, there's three lanes. There's a turning lane. There's two lanes that are going to continue on down towards Little Cottonwood Canyon, and the traffic's backed up. There's the turning lane. Those are going up Big Cottonwood Canyon. There's two lanes of traffic from Little Cottonwood Canyon, 6 miles away, down to here, Big Cottonwood Canyon, and down towards I-215. That's the parking lot of people waiting to get up the canyon on a snow day where they're doing avalanche control. And if I was to go out on the south end of Wasatch Boulevard. And from Little Cottonwood Canyon, they're backed up almost to Draper. If you were to go into Sandy on 94 South, they're backed up almost down to 20th and sometimes down to 13th East. And then there are also some of the folks that think they're kind of getting around it. They'll go into the subdivision. And this is a mess. And then our tourism people, Ski Utah, are getting emails from people, we're never coming here again. Because it took us 4 hours to get to skiing. You have the greatest snow on earth, but what good is that if you can't get there? This is a problem. I woke up probably about a year ago, and I'm thinking, it's taking me a lot longer to get anywhere. The congestion that we're facing on our roads, and this is after we've given our best effort, over two decades to build state roads, to widen them, to try and relieve congestion, provide the infrastructure for commerce, for deliveries, for people moving around, for people going to work. We are not going to keep up with it because we spend $600 million out of the general fund. And so I'm so pleased with where we got this session on a couple of issues. Transit. Transit is going to be huge for our future. And there's a lot of people that don't like it. UTA, there's a lot of distrust for UTA. And we've tried to reset UTA, work on their governance model, and give the local counties the option to increase their effort now, their taxing effort, to provide revenue for transit. We also began what is called the TTIF fund. That's the Transit TIF fund in the department, in UDOT, where the Transportation Commission now will prioritize grants to local governments as they now choose to increase their effort for transit. And those grants will be based on the local entity's effort to build workplace, workforce, entertainment, and recreational assets around those transit corridors. We will save billions and billions of dollars if we're smart about our growth. But if we don't, if we just let growth happen, like in Dallas or Atlanta, where they have unending land, we will face unbelievable costs for infrastructure, and we will face huge congestion. We made a big step with SB 136. That was Mike Schultz and Wayne Harper's bill. They were the leaders of this discussion over the interim. My hat's off to them. They made a heavy lift. We got a bill passed. Wasn't I where I wanted to go? I thought we should go further, but we made a huge step towards solving some of our transportation and infrastructure problems with that bill. I also sponsored a bill, which I usually don't sponsor bills, to create now a more robust tolling option for UDOT to look at, where we now can use a photographic way of identifying cars on the road and be able to now collect a toll. Tolling is a hated option by the public, but as more and more cars use other alternative fuels or their electric cars, eventually the gas tax, and my prediction is probably in the next decade to 15 years, that the gas tax will be obsolete. And how are we going to pay for the roads? Are we going to still continue to move money out of the general fund, leaving less money for education? We can't do that anymore. If you use the roads, you pay for the roads. And that's going to be through some kind of a vehicle miles driven or tolling. People hate the idea, but it's not reality going forward. And so we passed the tolling bill, which will now give UDOT that option to look at when they're designing roads and for the future, and not just on new capacity, but on existing capacity, because that's going to be part of what we deal with going forward. Just briefly, I think we made some progress on Medicaid expansion, and that was a big lift for both the House and the Senate. I was surprised. We've been usually a little bit more liberal about passing Medicaid expansion bills in the Senate, but we had a hard time getting that passed. But in the end of the day, it passed with 20 votes. And I think that's hats off to Senator Zender, a new senator who's a medical doctor who really worked the body. He reminded me of Dr. Shiazala, our former senator who now works for HHS in Denver. Those are just a couple of the items. There are a lot of other little smaller policy changes that are always important. And we passed a budget, and it's balanced. So we're happy with the session.
And I'm going to flip the script, but before I do that, transportation, that bill would not have passed without Democrats. So I want people to see that, because that vote was so close. And many of us got emails from our own constituents saying, well, you're going to do an EV charge, so you shouldn't support this bill at all. But I couldn't do that to my constituents for a small group within my district, because a larger group in my district depends on public transit. And UTA is just not doing what they need to do to make sure that you can get from the east side of the city to the east side of the city, back to the west side of the city in under an hour and a half. Just doesn't happen. But I want to flip the script, because a lot of times we forget about issues that I think are very, very important to all of us, even if we're male or female. And that is domestic violence and sexual assault. And that's a lot of the legislation I work on. This year, we had two companion bills, SB 27 and HB 165. And so we've revamped our dating and our stalking and all of those injunctions. Unfortunately, my HB 165 got stuck on the second reading calendar of the Senate and never passed. So one of the pieces of that large transition passed. The other, we'll have to wait until next year. But at the end of the day, I have four new bills that I can run next year and hopefully get them passed this time. But yeah, these are issues. And when we talk about public health, we talk about suicide, but we need to focus on the underlining issue, which is trauma. And so Representative Ivory ran some legislation to deal with trauma, because when you look at suicide, you look at sexual assault, you look at domestic violence, it all comes back to trauma and power and control. And a lot of times people are like, well, let's talk about roads, let's talk about this and that. And yeah, those are all essentials. But if we're not healthy people, we can't use those roads, we can't work, we can't function. And so I think what I bring to the table is unique, and I'll continue to do that.
And thank you for tuning in to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today, we are airing a discussion recorded at the end of last week with a panel of Utah state legislators to review this year's session and to discuss the bills that did or didn't pass and what it all means for the state moving forward. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today, we're airing a legislative wrap-up discussion recorded last Friday on March 8th at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. The panelists include Democrats Representative Brian King and Representative Angelo Romero, and Republican Speaker of the House Greg Hughes, as well as Senate President Wayne Niederhauser. And the conversation was moderated by Hinckley Institute Director Jason Perry.
Before we go to the audience, let me ask really quickly. Representative King, last night you said that this is one of the more progressive legislative sessions that you've seen in a long time. I thought that was an interesting phrase.
It was a great phrase. It was accurate. I mean, I said that because what we saw was the legislature responding in ways that they wouldn't have otherwise responded to the existence of those initiatives.
Well, so let's talk about those initiatives for a moment, because several of them will impact us here and our schools now in particular is one of those things. Talk about how you as a legislature look at some of those initiatives and a couple of your decisions you made maybe in response to or in coordination with them.
Well, the legislators feel, and I think this is natural and right, that they want to be protective of their turf, which is making law. And we have in the statutes of the state of Utah and the laws the ability for initiatives to be filed by the people. They have to gather a certain number of signatures. But if they do, they can basically bypass the legislature and stick on the ballot for people to vote on their own attempts to make law. I don't have a problem with that at all. But I think that when it happens, and I'd be surprised if the four of us don't agree on this, when that threat appears on the horizon, you find the legislature thinking, well, this is occurring because of some underlying frustration on the part of the people of the state of Utah that we're not responding to what at least a significant portion of the population would like. You had five initiatives this year. You have that are making their way possibly toward the ballot. We'll see if they get there or not. One is our schools now. One is medical marijuana. One is Medicaid expansion. One is better boundaries. And the last one is count my vote.
Don't forget, keep my voice.
Keep my voice and count my vote, I sort of lump in, okay, because they're flip sides of the same coin. You're right, though. There are six initiatives, strictly speaking, but there are five areas, subject areas. But every one of them deal with what I would characterize, partly to irritate the speaker, as progressive.
And I think he's going to have something to say about
that. Oh, I think he will, too. So we made progress in each one of those five areas. Better boundaries, we probably made the least. Made a lot of progress in count my vote. Not that one as much as our schools now. Our schools now is the one in Medicaid expansion, I think, were the two where we really made the most progress in terms of stepping up as a legislature and sort of addressing with substantive legislation those areas.
Very good.
So I'm worried that the narrative will be because these initiatives came forward, and remember, someone filing and beginning the signature process for an initiative doesn't necessarily mean that it will receive the amount of signatures necessary or even make its way on the ballot. So there's a lot of assumptions if you just see someone working towards gathering signatures that somehow means that there's a ballot proposition that would come. I will tell you, I know my caucus pretty well. We're large. I mean, if you have 75 seats and 62 are Republican, you have people that are representing districts that are very, very different from each other. So you have Representative Hall's district in West Valley City that doesn't look anything like Representative Noel's district in Kane County. So how do you find consensus in a caucus of Republicans where the districts and the constituents they represent are so different? I really believe, and it sounds Pollyanna, but I'm telling you, our caucus, we allow good decisions to drive good decisions, and we have robust debate. But I will tell you that if we began our conversation about education funding by – we have this gun against our head for the largest tax increase in state's history, or at least a proposal of it. What are we going to do? Many of my members would have said, I'm not going to act under threat. I'm not going to respond to that because then you'll just get more of that type of that kind of behavior. So what we really worked hard to do was get right on the policy. And we felt that we had a reform package that looked at tax cuts as well as looking at our property tax equalization, how that would fit in to how we fund our public schools. And we got right on that before we even began to discuss, because you can't ignore that our schools now had a $700 million tax increase that prospectively could hit the state. And for many of us, we think if you hit the income tax, you're penalizing productivity. We think when we lowered it, we saw with Governor Huntsman, we saw happen to this state and its economy what was advertised when Governor Huntsman proposed lowering the state income tax, that we would see productivity, we would see our economy grow. Going the other way, other direction and raising that up, and then looking at a really steep increase in sales tax, which hits lower income families as well as individuals, we thought that was going in the complete wrong direction. So if we got right on the policy, we then, as a caucus, wanted to reach out to our schools now and say, look, this is our level of effort. And by the way, over 4 years, over $1 billion of new revenue to public schools. And so we think that we already had a trajectory that we could point to. It wasn't flat or this, and then when they came around, it went like this. You saw this trajectory over a number of years. We wanted to show that level of effort on our part and see if instead of them looking to raise taxes this way and us looking to cut taxes this way and really going in opposite directions, could we find that overlap and find that agreement? We did, and I'm very proud of our caucus for having done that. But again, I don't think that's done under duress. I don't think that's done under threat. I think that's done the way you'd want your representatives in the legislature and the Republican caucus, but then again, it's been noted, you know, on the floor of the House in a bipartisan way. You do this with your colleagues, and it's just these ballot questions are myopic in nature, but the budget certainly is not, and policy is not. If you're an intern, you saw a lot of policies, unintended consequences. That's what we're always staring at. It's it might not be the best system, but it's the best one we have, I would argue. So anyway, I think that to counter my friend here, I do not think that that drove those discussions, but I do think that it certainly was part of that in trying to show that level of effort.
President, you want to comment about that? And maybe a little description about what this solution does do and going forward into this next election also.
When I look at what initiatives are out there and they're getting signatures right now, there was really only a couple that we addressed, but these were issues that we've been working on for years before the initiative even came forth. And I think the speaker's last comment is that, yeah, it had some effect. I don't think we would have put a ballot question on the ballot whether we should raise gas tax 10 cents without that compromise. But I think we would have passed the other part of the package anyway. We almost got to it last year, the freezing of the rate in the House and in the Senate. We were very close to that last year. And we've been working on lowering the rates and doing single sales factor, giving incentives for companies to come here and have employment and having offices and plants, so to speak, or equipment. We've been penalizing companies to come here because we've had this triple-weighted apportionment to the way we tax corporations, and now we're going to do single sales factor. That's going to be a real help to attracting businesses to Utah and giving you folks here at the university or trying to find a job more opportunity in the future. So we were already going down that road, and I think the only element that I see that the outcome is a little bit different is that ballot question. And on Medicaid expansion, we got indications from the Trump administration that we should pass this seek for these waivers. Please come and give us a chance to see if we can grant those waivers to you. That was without an initiative, and I believe that was the motivation for that. So,
okay, Representative Romero.
And then I'll circle back with Representative King. I really think a lot of people feel like their voice isn't represented, and it puts us as elected officials on check. And what I tell people, you know, if you're working on an initiative, and although we've done what we've done here, if you really, really don't like the job we're doing, you need to get out there and vote. Because I have people coming to me all the time complaining about this guy, not him,
not you.
And I'm like, well, do you vote? You know, what district do you live in? And they can't even tell me who their senator or their representative is. And I'm like, do you know who your city mayor is? Hopefully. And so, do you know who the lieutenant governor is? I go, we as citizens also need to be informed, because it's easy to point fingers at us, the elected officials, for the decisions we have to make. Because my world, the way I see running government, is probably very different than these two. But at the end of the day, we still have to negotiate. And although we are a super minority, doesn't mean we still don't have a voice in that process. And that's what I always put out to people. I'm like, if you really want to create change and you're not happy with the job we're doing, then get out and vote and get the people you know out to vote. Because it's easy to say, I don't like what you're doing here, I don't like what you're doing there, but get out to vote and some of us will help you. And we just passed, we did a whole reform on our election laws. And so that's another thing we didn't talk about.
You use the word super, though. Don't you like to call yourself the super minority leader?
Well, they've introduced me as a minority leader, and they kiss me all the time.
I like to use the word micro.
It's super
minority.
Oh, boy.
I'm the super minority leader.
Super minority leader.
He is, you know, if he keeps it up, I'm going to start using
him. Hey, I am a victim of, you know, workplace harassment with him. I just want you to know. It's actually on, I'm on the dais. There's actual video evidence of it. So he punches me. He actually punches me on my arm.
And he whined to me. On the bias. He looks at me and says, this is what makes you rest.
I'm putting you on notice, pal.
Talk about okay.
Me too.
Way.
Oh, boy. All right, we're going to move on for just a moment.
I thought I was speaking his language. He's a pugilist.
Well, he is a boxer. So let's take a moment, take some questions from the audience. How about that?
Hi, I'm Andrew. I just have a question for the president. When you talked about how does Utah replace the gas tax, how do we fill that tax void now that more people are going to electric vehicles or alternative fuels, things like that? I know there was a bill that proposed just a flat tax upon those owners of electric vehicles, which I'm pretty sure did not pass, did not make it far. But is there no way to tax electric car owners in a way that it's done by not just by miles driven, but by the value of their car? That way, those who own a Tesla or another nice electric car are charged proportionally to those who might have a Volt or something of that nature.
So that did pass. That was in the transportation bill that I mentioned, SB 136. There was a fee placed on electric vehicles to help them pay for the road because they don't pay gas, or they don't use gas, or not paying gas tax. I think that's a temporary solution to for at least electric vehicles. And while it wasn't in the bill, I thought it was initially in the bill, but we put some intent language in the bill of bills, which was our last budget bill that we passed last night at 5 to midnight.
Some of us were holding our breath on all
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, I know. Jonathan, our fiscal analyst, was having a heart attack in the back of the Senate that we were so close to midnight passing that bill. But in there was some intent language that we would now funnel some of those fees that electric vehicles are going to pay for EV infrastructure, places where you can plug your car in. Because if we're ever going to have more electric vehicles, we've got to have more infrastructure for those electric vehicles to charge. And, you know, the technology is going to solve a lot of these problems. It's amazing what you can do with an app today. Combine electronic tolling or vehicle miles driven with technology, an app on your phone where you'll be able to choose to pay to drive in certain lanes, drive in certain hours of the day. There'll be collaboration apps, which we already have, for carpooling. And when we can't get up a canyon, so to speak, and there's no parking up there anyway, you can't put more cars up there. We've got to build some parking garages in Sandy and Cottonwood Heights. If we're talking about the Cottonwood Canyons, get people out of their cars, get in some buses, carpool. Those are the answers going forward, and that seems pretty progressive. But that's a reality. I'm a conservative, but I'm also a realist on how we're going to have to deal with the funding of our roads and infrastructure in the future. Now, you mentioned just a kind of a fixed fee or a flat fee. Well, there is that element, but there needs to be some kind of a variable cost to using the road, and that you use it, you pay for it. So there might be a fixed amount that you use, but it should be a combination of a minimal amount of fixed payment, but there should be a variable payment based on your use of the road. That way you incentivize, you create a balance of supply and demand for the use of those roads when people are realizing the full cost of driving on them. Does that answer your question?
And we also have to think about how we build and making sure we have walkable communities so people aren't always on the road or in single vehicles, EV. I'm a big supporter of EV, you know. My next car is probably going to be an EV or a hybrid because I can afford it. And I'm not saying that other people can't, but we also have to look about how we build and how we use mass transit and how we look at affordable housing. And so it's all within infrastructure, and that's where we as the state need to work with municipalities and counties to make sure that happens. And we're also moving to Tier 3, so we have to look at, when it comes to gas, we have to look at a lot of infrastructure there.
Okay, this question is for Speaker Hughes. And I understand if you don't want to answer, if you can't answer it.
I answer everything.
Wow. That's quite the lead in.
I love it. I love questions that start that way.
So I know you're stopping, you know, Speaker of the House. I love your charisma, your personality. You know, this is all fun. This is great stuff. I'm just wondering if we can see more of you potentially run for governor. If you can answer, I get it, but or just more in Utah politics.
So I'm not a church mouse, so I don't think I'm going to go away. I'm 48 years old. I ran when I was 32, so it's those are formative years. I'm going to tell you. I purposefully, so you know, and this is a straight up answer. This isn't. I'm not ducking this question. This is straight up. I didn't want any decision of what I would want to do or what I would think about or consider doing color my decision-making process as speaker. Meaning that some of the things, if you're going to do something that's impactful, it's inherently hard. And by hard, I mean there are going to be plenty of people that don't like it. It is so easy. If you watch Washington, D.C., the fallback is no. Somehow we have convinced ourselves, or some have, that there's something valiant about a no vote. Well, if all you can do in the legislative process is get to no, and you can never get to the math of 38 in the House and 15 in the Senate, and you never get to that number, then all you're doing is perpetuating the status quo. You're never moving the needle. Anything that would do that requires heft. It requires work. And you're going to make people mad when you do it. If I was looking at other options, I think I've seen it. I've watched it with other public servants who've looked at other offices or have contemplated other elected service, that it makes them risk averse. They don't want to do this. They're worried about whether it makes them. I'm not built that. I don't think I do that anyway. But I did try to compartmentalize my time while I'm on the clock as speaker to do what we had to do. And I'm telling you, I think we made those heavy lifts. And I don't know if that bodes well for future prospects for me or not. I don't know. Look, I have battle scars head to toe. If you want a candidate that's just newly born skin, unblemished, never, you know, doesn't have any battle scars, I am definitely not your candidate. I think friends come and go and enemies accumulate in this business, and I've got plenty. So I don't know. The answer is I have no idea, but I just can't imagine that I'm going to go in a hole somewhere. But I don't know what the future holds yet.
Does anyone else want to comment on his future?
What they want it to be? No, you cannot.
I'm going to miss fighting with him. Like, yeah. He and I fight all behind the scenes.
It's actually a bonding moment.
Yeah, it's a bonding moment. It is. I'm weird. Like, did you go tanning today? You know?
And I did.
Yeah. Or I'll text him. I'm like, if I'm late to church, it's your fault. My grandma's going to call you. Yeah, but, you know, I think.
We all agreed on that time certain representative. I keep trying to tell you, that was a motion on the floor.
But
the
it
time
was
certain.
Ash Wednesday.
Yeah, I don't think you've resolved this one. Did you have a comment there, Representative?
I will miss the speaker. Yeah, I really will. He and I get along well for the most part. There are times when we disagree, and there are times when I'm mad at him. But I think that I was a phrase that's come to mind from Tom Peters' book, In Search of Excellence, is bias toward action. Speaker has a bias toward action.
That's very nice. Now, President, you are stepping down as the President of the Senate.
Highly likely that I won't run as president.
Okay, well,
that was right. But I want to make a comment about the speaker also. I've gotten to know the speaker over about the last 6 to 8 years. We've been involved in a lot of things together. And there's things that the speaker has been able to pull off that nobody else can. What he's done for the homeless is amazing. And our hat's off, my hat's off to him as president of the Senate. To have that kind of, and while you might see a lot of scars here, I've seen his heart too, and he's a softy inside. So just want to let you know that.
I can attest to it also.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today, we're airing a wrap-up of the 2018 Utah Legislative Session featuring House Speaker Greg Hughes, Representatives Brian King and Angela Romero, as well as Senate President Wayne Niederhauser. The conversation was moderated by Jason Perry, Director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. In this final segment, the group talks about upcoming retirements in the Utah Legislature, and towards the end of the segment, they take questions from the audience.
Now, we have quite a few retirements announced in the legislature, more that I wasn't even aware of.
I got a call from the Tribune today. They liked it. They were surprised.
Yeah, right in the phone. Sorry.
So I was driving up and I answered my phone and it was the Tribune and they're like, did you know Mike Noel was retiring? And it like, I didn't know what to say. And I was like, what?
Why are they calling you?
Because he loves me.
That's why.
And, you know, and I wanted to cry. It was, you know, we may not agree on anything, but as the speaker pointed out, we're like a little family. We fight, we're dysfunctional amongst ourselves sometimes, but at the end of the day, we're family. And when, you know, Mike Noel, I would never vote for any of his bills regarding Donald Trump or public lands. And I've swore at him on the floor, but the speaker's never heard. But at the end of the day, that man has my back. And if it wasn't for Mike Noel, and I tell people this, I wouldn't have secured $1.2 million for sexual assault. At mandating this, you know, getting the sexual assault kits tested, because he was there, my little champion in the background. Nobody knew because he didn't yell it out to the world. And so I think for us, when we lose someone from the house, it's like losing a part of your family, even if it's your uncle that you don't, you know, agree with, or your grandpa.
I was really surprised to see Mike leave. And it is a weird, I have to say, discomforting to see the bond that Angela and Mike formed. It was very troubling. I mean, some people say that maybe about me and the speaker. Me and the speaker are like this, but to Mike and Angela, way over there and way over here, and yet they're buddies, and I kind of go, it's weird. But it is true what Representative Romero said, and you see people come and go, and you see them leave, and it really tugs at your heartstrings when I got word the speaker was kind enough to text me and tell me he was leaving the day that he was leaving, the morning before he announced it to his caucus, and I was sitting in the dentist chair. I got this text. I was looking at it, and the dentist was working on, he was cleaning my teeth. He said, are you feeling a lot of pain? Have I hurt you? And I said, no. And he said, because you've got tears in your eyes. I said, yeah, I do.
Yeah. I got things in my eyes. You got odd dust in this room. This is a very unhealthy climate for you young students to be in. There's a lot of particles in here. I would just tell you this. This is what I love so much about our Utah State Legislature. By show of hands, how many interns do we have that were here? Okay. I just want to thank you for the work that you've done and to be part of what we do. How many were surprised that watched this process, the amount of bills that pass in a bipartisan supermajority way? How many were shocked that most bills pass 60, 70 votes? I mean, the public understands that governance and doing the work, the bills that we file, they don't neatly fit into party politics all the time. There are some, and it's like, you know, those are the ones that the media will highlight. But there's so much work that we do together. And we had a lot of retirements announced on the floor. And we don't have term limits in the legislature in our state. And yet you see this high turnover, and this is why. The more you know, the more you do. The more you do, the more time it takes. And the more time it takes, the more it takes you away from your day job. We could not live on what we receive by way of compensation as a part-time lawmaker for that 7.5 weeks of session and in our meetings during the interim. It takes you away from those responsibilities. And at some point, the burden becomes too heavy and you have to move on. And so you have this blend. I came in 2003 as my first session. There's only two members that were there when I arrived. And I've seen many, many seats change with multiple lawmakers that have represented them. But this is what you get when you see something like that happen. You get the institutional memory. You get the backbench. And they've seen bills. A lot of bills that come have come before. A lot of the debates we've had before. And so there's that institutional memory and knowledge of, this has been brought before us before. This is how we responded to it. And there's a depth of understanding of the budget and all the moving parts as you've been there longer. But then you have your freshmen that come in and are newly elected. And with that passion and with that zeal of being a public servant for even the first time. And it reminds the backbenchers and the people that have been there so long that might get jaded after a number of terms why we're here and what public service means and that excitement that comes, that blend that you saw if you were serving in the House or the Senate and if you've ever thought of being an intern or being a part of that process, that blend of lawmakers is unbelievable. And it's why you'll find even people that don't agree on policy when you watch TV, you'll see emotion here and you'll see friendships here and you'll see what I would hope public policy would be about. And that is, you can respectfully disagree, but you can have a deep well of respect for each other.
President, did you have a comment? Sorry, grab my phone.
This session, we saw more bills pass splitting both our caucuses than I've ever seen before, where I'd have Democrats that would vote yes, Democrats that would vote no, Republicans voting yes and no. I saw more split votes in splitting Republicans and Democrats than I've ever seen in my days in the legislature. And just to highlight, the speaker talks about the back row. Well, the back row in the Senate are people that have been there like for 30, 40 years, and we're going to lose two of those this year. And that's Senator Howard Stevenson, who's been there for 26 years, and Senator Pete Knutson, that's been in the legislature, I think, for about 24, at least 24 years. And they're both retiring this year. So there's going to be some changes.
Good afternoon. We are visiting Salt Lake City, and we were invited to attend this panel. So it's for the benefit of our group. I was wondering, could you please explain the structure and the institutions involved in the lawmaking process so that we understand it better? And because you're talking about transportation or how to tax cars on the roads, just for an example, because I'm from Singapore, and we have something called ERP, which is electronic road pricing, which helps them decide how the car, so you have a panel on your car and it automatically gets deducted, and it's based on the time of the day, so if it's peak hour or off peak hour, and then on the size of the vehicle. So if you're considering a framework or a model to adapt, so maybe you can consider the Singapore model for ERP.
We're headed that way. Only we won't even need a card. The cars will be identified otherwise through a license plate or something that's actually built into the car. That's the future, and that's Utahns and people in the United States are going to have to go that way in the future, just with their growth. But to tell you about our process, just briefly, there's a Italian restaurant in Sandy, and they make sausage. And you can watch them. Well, you can watch them make sausage, and it's really ugly looking. And that's how we make law in Utah. You kind of wonder, how does the United States do what they do with the processes that they have? But it's rooted in the people. That's the difference I see in our form of government in the United States and many governments across the world. It's right at its grassroots level. The people have a voice. The people elect their officials, and we represent those officials, or we represent that constituency in a legislative process where the speaker laid it out pretty well. You've got Mike Noel covering a very conservative part of Utah. You've got others that are covering Salt Lake City and other places. Everybody has different ideas, and we have to come together on all those ideas and make everything work. And I am sold on the process. I call our legislative session our 45-day forum of free speech, where any person of any mind can bring a piece of legislation to that process. And we have ways of dealing with it, but at the end of the day, we have to either vote yes or we have to vote no. And some of those ideas may look pretty crazy, but you never want to suppress it, or you're suppressing free speech. And that's so fundamental to America and so fundamental to a Utah to have those kind of forums.
Hi, thank you for being here and inviting us, and being an intern was an incredible opportunity. I'm Carolyn Cox. I was the intern for Representative Carol Speckman Moss. So one thing that I really learned in this process was how valuable it is to have two differing voices that have pretty much equal power. And when you don't have that, you don't really have good debates. I saw a lot of good debates, but I also saw things that are, I kind of just shake my head and really wonder. But I, you know, I haven't been in, like Speaker Hughes said, this is his 16th session. Representative Moss, it's her 18th session. I haven't been doing this as long as you, so I don't say, hey, I know better than you. But I, this leads into my question. So I live in the West Point area where the Inland Port is going in, and it's a very industrial area that, as you know, the airport, the National Guard, a whole bunch of industry, the oil refineries and everything are out there. It stinks. It's polluted. It's crap. But it's also been called the new sugar house of Utah because it's really one of the only affordable places left for people to move to in Salt Lake County. What I would ask is, somebody made the comment that you really listen to constituents, but sometimes constituents don't know exactly what's best for them. West Point gave Representative Hollins a run for her money on this. They really fought hard against that Inland Port. And I'm wondering, what is it that West Point constituents don't understand about the Inland Port that everyone else in the state does understand? And I'll also just make one comment. I'm a graduate here from the University of Utah from the David Eccles School of Business. And the one thing I learned above everything else in that school is that businessmen will make decisions that help their bottom line above almost everything else, including social impact.
So I worked on this very hard. And, you know, Representative Gibson, myself, and Senator Jerry Stevenson, we spent during the session as members of our House and Senate leadership, we went to a two-hour work study meeting at the city council. So not just representatives from your area, but from the whole city. And I don't know that you will have found a meeting like that where we'd come off the hill and come down to the city to dialogue. I know the three of us, again, we were at the state fairgrounds, and we spent a Saturday there talking with residents about why we felt this was important, not just for the opportunities, the economic opportunities of an inland port, but for jobs. I will tell you that you can have a politician put any number to any spreadsheet they want, but it's the taxpayers. It's the people whose jobs pay the bills, pay the taxes that actually allow government to do what it's going to do. You have a supply-side legislature that believes that if the economy is strong and people are able to make a wage that they can feed their family, support them, that is how we're all going to get through this together. So we look at opportunities like the Inland Port, and we make our best case, and we talk about the jobs and the opportunities that we think we will bring to Utah, but even to that area, if we're able to be successful. And we think that's worth talking about and worth noting, and we wouldn't spend that Saturday in an area that we don't represent personally if we didn't have that genuine desire to be understood or to at least share that context, a deeper context. I will tell you this, though. We had four Salt Lake County mayors that lost in the last November election, and they were what was described as pro-growth mayors. What did that mean? That meant that they were allowing and supporting multifamily housing, which we have a housing shortage, an affordable housing shortage in this valley. But what's happening is for those leaders that are learning and seeing and identifying that we need more affordable housing and they're making those decisions, guess who's really, really upset about that? The neighborhoods, the communities. And so when you ask, when the neighborhood says, why would we ever want this? And it's not belittling neighborhoods. When we were doing Operation Rio Grande, I went to St. Patrick's. You know, I went to the St. Patrick's Cultural Hall in where was that? Poplar Grove Catholic Church. We went to the ballpark. We went to Avenues. We went to Third West. Anyway, all over the place. And a lot of the conversation started to drive to the same place: housing. What are we going to do if someone's experiencing homelessness? How do you get to the affordable housing transition, which is very difficult? When we talked about that in the macro, everybody was getting along. The wet blanket in the meeting is when I said, how about here? How about here in the avenues? How about here in this neighborhood? And everything got quiet. And I'm going to say that we have to start talking a lot more often. We have to start dialoguing, because if it's the case that we need all of these things to happen, a good economy, opportunities for employment, housing that's affordable, but it can never be near me because my neighborhood won't have it. Four mayors lost because they were trying to accommodate better housing options for people. I'm going to tell you, bottom line down to that. So I would argue that we just have to do a better job of seeing this more collectively together. The neighborhood, it's not just that neighborhood there. It's more broad than that. And I think that if we can do that together, have people that don't represent that area come and explain their perspective, have that perspective that would come back. Look at the bill for Inland Port. It's not lip service, but it memorializes environmental stewardship, making sure that the impact of the surrounding communities is a positive and not a negative. That those very words are found in that bill. And it's not meant to just tip a hat or check a box. There is that genuine intent. And it came, that drafting of that came after our time at the Fifth State Fairgrounds. So I guess my answer is we're going to try and talk and dialogue more often, but that's the key, I think.
Anyone have one final comment on this?
We all have different opinions on the Inland Port. As the speaker knows, I was a no vote. And my biggest concerns, and I know we put the environmental stuff in there, is those environmental impacts on our community. Because even with the prison going there, there's environmental impacts. And so I want to make sure that we're preserving that. And so those are concerns for me. But some of our constituents feel, and you know, the speaker, and I'm not trying to duel here with him, but they feel like it's a land grab. And so, you know, that's how Salt Lake City feels, and a lot of Salt Lake City residents feel. And that's where we're not always in agree, but we have to have these conversations. And my only thing with the Inland Port, I just wish we would have had more conversation on the floor, because someone called called the question, and some of our lights were still on. And, you know, but that's the process. And so what do we have to do differently next time? And how do we have these conversations in the community? Because at the end of the day, the speaker is right to some. I'll agree with him on some points. It's going to bring economic development, and much needed for the state of Utah. But I have my concerns, and my constituents and Representative Hall's kitchens have concerns, and our city has concerns.
Okay, our last comment from the president.
Just, I think I identified one of the positive notes, and Representative just identified it also, is that it will transform that area. There'll be redevelopment. And you mentioned some of the blight that might occur in that area. I think that will be changed to more dense housing. Hopefully that'll be affordable type of housing. So the positive about this is that it will blossom and grow and be vibrant, hopefully in the future, as long as we can make it work. So it's good. It was a good thought and good vision you have of what the possibilities are there.
All right. We're so great for our panelists. I know it's been about 3 hours of sleep for you, so it's so nice of you to be willing to do this. Let's give a hand for these really great, great panelists.
You can find a full recording of the discussion between Representative Brian King, Representative Angela Romero, Speaker of the House Greg Hughes, and Senate President Wayne Niederhauser on our website at kcpw.org or on the podcast version of the show. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your humble curator and newest producer of this program. Thank you for listening.